This chapter fully describes how Hiranyakashipu obtained power from Lord Brahma and misused it by harassing all the living entities within this universe. By severe austerities, Hiranyakashipu satisfied Lord Brahma and obtained the benedictions he desired. After he received these benedictions, his body, which had almost been entirely consumed, was revived with full beauty and a luster like gold. Nonetheless, he continued to be envious of Lord Vishnu, unable to forget Lord Vishnu's having killed his brother. Hiranyakashipu conquered everyone in the 10 directions and the 3 worlds, and brought all living entities, both demigods and asuras, under his control. Becoming the master of all places, including the residents of Indra, whom he had driven out, he began enjoying life in great luxury and thus became mad. All the demigods, but Lord Vishnu, Lord Brahma, and Lord Shiva, came under his control and began serving him. But despite all his material power, he was dissatisfied because he was always puffed up, proud of transgressing the Vedic regulations. All the brahmanas were dissatisfied with him, and they cursed him with determination. Eventually, all the living entities within the universe, represented by the demigods and sages, prayed to the Supreme Lord for relief from Hiranyakashipu's rule. Lord Vishnu informed the demigods that they and the other living entities would be saved from the fearful conditions created by Hiranyakashipu. Since Hiranyakashipu was the oppressor of all the demigods, the followers of the Vedas, the cows, the brahmanas, and the religious saintly persons, and since he was envious of the Supreme Lord, he would naturally be killed very soon. Hiranyakashipu's last exploit would be to torment his own son Prahlad, who was a Mahabhagavat, an exalted Vaishnava. Thus his life would end. When the demigods were thus reassured by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, everyone was satisfied, knowing that the miseries inflicted upon them by Hiranyakashipu would come to an end. Finally, Narada Muni describes the characteristics of Prahlad Maharaj, the son of Hiranyakashipu, and describes how his father envied his own qualified son. In this way, the chapter ends. Which verse is on the board? Again? 1 or 2? Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, 7th Canto, Chapter 4, Hiranyakashipu Terrorizes the Universe, Text 2. Sri Brahmovacha, Tate me durlabha pumsam. Yan vrinishe varan mama, tatapi vitaram yanga, varan yadyapi durlabhan, tate me durlabha pumsam, yan vrinishe varan mama, tatapi Vitaram Yanga Varan Yadyapi Durlabhan Tate Me Durlabha Pumsam Yan Vrinishe Varan Mama Tatapi Vitaram Yanga Varan Yadyapi Durlabhan. Vaishnavis. Sri Brahma Uvacha. Lord Brahma said, Tata, O dear son, Ime, all these, Durlabha, very rarely obtained, Pum Sam, by men, Yan, those which, Vinishe, you ask, Varan, benedictions, mama, from me, tatapi, still, vitarami, I shall deliver, anga, O Hiranyakashipu, Puran, the benedictions, yadyapi, although, durlaban, not generally available. We'll read text one and then text two. Narada Muni continued, Lord Brahma was very much satisfied by Hiranyakashipu's austerities, which were difficult to perform. Therefore, when solicited for benedictions, he indeed granted them, although they were rarely to be achieved. Text two. Lord Brahma said, O Hiranyakashipu, these benedictions for which you have asked are difficult to obtain for most men. Nonetheless, O my son, I shall grant you them, although they are generally not available. Purport. Material benedictions are not always exactly worthy of being called benedictions. If one possesses more and more, a benediction itself may become a curse. For just as achieving material opulence in this material world requires great strength and endeavor, maintaining it also requires great endeavor. Lord Brahma informed Hiranyakashipu that although he was ready to offer him whatever he had asked, the result of the benedictions would be very difficult for Hiranyakashipu to maintain. Nonetheless, since Brahma had promised, he wanted to grant all the benedictions asked. The word durlaban indicates that one should not take benedictions one cannot enjoy peacefully. Om Gana Timadandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhunitananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sivasri Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hiranyakashipu has achieved his benedictions through the most extraordinary labors of austerity. And now he thinks enjoyment time has come. We may be a little confused hearing about Lord this and Lord that, thinking that Srimad Bhagavatam is presenting polytheism. But that is totally not the case. The Srimad Bhagavatam presents existence as a hierarchy of consciousness, a nested hierarchy of consciousness. So the lower consciousnesses, or the less developed consciousnesses, are enclosed within a framework in which there are higher and higher levels of consciousness. And of course, the Bhagavatam presents Krishna as the supreme consciousness. So Lord Brahma is just an agent, albeit a very powerful agent, the most advanced consciousness in the universe. Nevertheless, he's not supreme. But Hiranyakashipu, as an extraordinary materialist, doesn't care. He wants what he wants. He wants material power that is unrivaled. He wants material influence and enjoyment that is practically endless, and he's done his best to get that. What you see here is something that plagues religions all over the world. Prosperity. If we are devoted, then shouldn't we be rewarded with material benefits? And indeed, isn't it so that material benefits are the proof that you're getting the mercy of God? Hiranyakashipu is an extreme example of ignoring whatsoever any spiritual benefit and focusing 100% on material advancement, material luxury, and material happiness. And he's going to get it any way he can, except he will not approach the Supreme Personality of Godhead for these things, because he has an extraordinary envy complex. So he's going to approach the lesser personalities in the hierarchy of consciousness. In effect, he's going to bribe them. Rather than go to the mayor, you go to a department head in the city and you give a bribe if you're in India. So if you're in the USA, you contribute to, what is that, those campaign funds now called? Yes. It's another way of giving a bribe. So Hiranyakashipu has no doubt about it. Any kind of apparent religious activity only has one purpose, that is to give me power and enjoyment. But he refuses to approach the Supreme Personality of Godhead for that, because he's extraordinarily envious of the Supreme Absolute Truth. So he's going to lower officials in the hierarchy and bribing them by his performing extreme and excruciating austerities. And now his time has come. Material enjoyment that's unrivaled. So as you're explaining, a prosperity religion is a non-sectarian phenomenon. You'll find it in the USA. You'll find it in India. You'll find it here, there, and everywhere. If there is a supreme, the result should be that by my devotion to God, I should be materially happy. I have this discussion with my mother all the time when I visit her. If she goes on a nice vacation, she'll say, "Praise the Lord." If my sister comes by with a new dress on, my mother will, rejoice. "Oh, isn't that a wonderful dress? Praise him." And then they'll do the high five like, athletes. So I always try to very respectfully explain, "Mother, are you sure this is what you really want to be praising and glorifying God about? Isn't the real benefit from God pure love and devotion? So much so that you say, 'Not my will, but thy will be done.'" So we have a deep discussion. "Well, you should recognize everything as the blessings of God." But I try to explain that some material luxuries or material benefits may actually turn out to be quite burdensome. So we were having a discussion last month when I visited in Ann Arbor. And so my relatives were saying, "You should be very thankful that your mother had you so educated. That was a blessing of God." And so I said, "Well, I don't know. I don't want to really think about what I was doing at the university while I was getting those blessings." And of course, I ceased doing such things many decades ago, but no, it was all a blessing of God that you and your brothers and sisters were so highly educated. And so I tried to explain that the actual blessing of God is pure devotion, so much so that you simply think of how to serve God for his pleasure, and you're not concerned with your own well-being, knowing that you'll be taken care of automatically in the best way. The example I often give is of a child who has very good parents. What child? Oh, there are no children here now, are they? No. What child with a very good parent, let's say you're a 5-year-old, 4-year-old kid, do you know any 4-year-old kids who are worried about, you know, what's the housing market like? How are the interest rates? Is the value of our house, is it going up or down? You don't know any 4-year-old kids who have that kind of worry. The 4-year-old kid doesn't go in the pantry and say, do we have enough food in stock for tomorrow? No, the kid just relies on the parents, knowing my parents are nice and loving, everything will be taken care of. Therefore, the kid can just play in peace, of course, until he has to go to school. And then he realizes that he is a consumer in a consumer society. And he becomes influenced by, number one, habitual patterns of consumption. His family consumed at a certain level, and so he takes that as the standard. And, of course, in the American way, you should always try to increase the standard of consumption beyond which your parents got. But as we pointed out last week, this is not happening now. In fact, the present generation of college students cannot look forward to the same level of material advancement as their parents. So this causes quite some psychological distress, that you graduate from school and you look forward to living with your parents for many years and paying off loans, and then struggling in a job market in which a great portion of the fastest growing jobs don't require a college degree at all. So a child who has good parents and who is very young is peaceful. The child doesn't worry, how will I be maintained? The child doesn't worry, where's my daily bread coming from? An actual devotee of God is like a child in his or her dependency. Simply, thy will be done. I just want some service to God for the pleasure of God. This is the message of bhakti, pure love and devotion. The living entity simply exists for the pleasure of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, from the material point of view, this looks like a very severe kind of life. I mean, what are you going to do for yourself? What about your pleasure? Why are you so hung up about God? You should be enjoying. And in fact, doesn't God want you to enjoy? Often we hear when we're speaking at colleges, well, if there's a God, obviously he gave us these bodies to enjoy. All right, you can answer that point on two levels. Number one, are you sure you know what enjoyment is? Maybe you have confused material enjoyment to be as something substantial. And number two, maybe you should ask yourself the question, if God gave us these bodies to enjoy, then how come you're not enjoying? Maybe there's a fault in the process. Or maybe, as Srimad Bhagavatam so exhaustively explains, maybe you have mistaken the body for the self and material enjoyment for the actual enjoyment of the spirit self. So this idea that devotion, theistic devotion to God should be visible in material comfort and happiness as the result. This phenomenon affects the whole world. The real luxury of the soul is pure devotion, pure love of God, without any desire for material benefit. So certainly, I concluded in my discussion with my mother, yes, it's good to thank God for everything. At the same time, it would be better to understand what is the real gift from God. In other words, if we have material desires, it certainly is better to approach the Supreme Lord for the fulfillment of our material desires, our hopes for material happiness. Better to do that than not at all. Because, Srimad Bhagavatam explains, when you approach Krishna for material benefit, although you're not very intelligent, at least you're connecting. You're making a connection. You're like a silly little kid who asks for the wrong thing. But at least you're asking your parent. There's some connection there. And based on that connection, the parent can gradually arrange that you come to a higher standard of intelligence. It's like you have a wealthy father, and you're a four-year-old kid, and the father says, ask for me whatever you like. And you figure, well, what's the best thing Dad can give me? I know. Dad, I'd like a pack of chewing gum. You obviously are very inexperienced and not very intelligent, because the father can give you so much more that is better. A material relative example. Similarly, when we approach the Supreme Lord for material happiness, we're like little kids asking for a pack of chewing gum. Material happiness is so transitory. It comes and goes, and it is not substantial. Hiranyakashipu is about to inflict extraordinary terror just in his quest for material happiness. He is now very proud that he has the means to control everyone for his own enjoyment. I was speaking at Stanford on, what day was it? Tuesday. That was just a few days ago. And our theme was escaping mass illusion, the cookie cutter and higher consciousness. So I explained to the students there, what is cookie-cutter consciousness? No matter how individual and variegated we think we are, no matter how stylistic we think we are, there's a basic cookie-cutter that our material consciousness comes out of. That I am this body and mind, and the purpose of life is to give pleasure to my body and mind. And if I am religious, religion should also give pleasure to the body and mind. So I call this the mass illusion that one way or another we buy into, either as a crass atheist materialist or as a prosperity religionist. We buy into this mirage that I am the body and mind, and therefore happiness and prosperity is signified by what happens to my body and mind. I describe this at Stanford as mass consensual trance. Vaisheshika Prabhu, he really liked that one. He's repeating it all the time. That in mass, billions of people buy into this, and they become trance-like. Mass consensual trance. It's actually a term from social psychology. Not often used, but it's very appropriate for our purposes. It looks normal because everyone, practically speaking, has bought into it. That I want my body and mind to be happy because that's me. Now, actually, you can't, in one sense, you can't blame people for thinking like this, because they have no knowledge of the spirit soul. At best, there is some vague understanding that I'm kind of spiritual in some kind of way, but the precise spiritual engineering knowledge is missing. If I am not the body and mind, that means the pleasures of the body and mind are actually not the pleasures I should be addressing. If I am spirit soul, part of the supreme soul, the luxuries I'm looking for are in the exchange of pure devotion with the supreme soul. That is real opulence, luxury. That is real advancement of the individual and society. But forgetting our spiritual identity as part of the supreme soul, part of Krishna, instead we plunge into varying degrees of a lifetime pursuit of, well, as the Declaration of Independence says, the pursuit of happiness, which is a very appropriate term. You're running after it, pursuing it. But you don't exactly know what will make you happy. You think you're the body and mind, so you pursue the pleasures of matter, sometimes even in the name of religiosity. And as I said, this prosperity religion complex affects the whole world. It's non-sectarian. So I was speaking to students Tuesday, and I was discussing how people are actually not as strong in their core self as they think they are. Generally, people think that I know what's right and I know what's wrong. And I mean, I may slip every once in a while, but, you know, everyone does. I'm not the greatest saint. I'm not the worst sinner. And, you know, basically, I can handle myself in whatever situations come my way. But social psychologists will point out that we should become more humble. We are more affected by our circumstances than ordinarily we're aware of. We are very pliable based on social pressures, social influences. Just like when you're a little kid, first you start playing with a few toys, and then you become a consumer. And consumers are affected by, number one, habitual patterns of consumption, the level of opulence that your family has become accustomed to, that level becomes yours, and naturally you want to increase it. And number two, social comparison. You look around at the people in your neighborhood, in your city, in your nation, what do they have? And naturally you become affected. So our core being, materially speaking, is subject to so much distortion, even to the extent that apparently normal people can do horrible things. So how did I present this at Stanford? I gave them research about suicide bombers. Now, generally, we would think to be a suicide bomber, you have to be just nuts. You have to be distorted, perverted, psychotic. Who would strap a bomb to themselves and blow it up in a public place? Who would ever do that? You'd have to be crazy. However, research by forensic psychologists into suicide bombers have shown, they took a group of 400 of them, Al-Qaeda members, and they found out that the vast majority, more than two-thirds of them, were highly educated, and they were married, had children. In fact, the psychologists analyzing them said, these people are not normal. They are above the norm. They are your ideal citizens of that part of the world. So then the question is, how do they become recruited to be suicide bombers? Well, this is what happened. These were people who were outraged at injustice. We're not going to go into the politics of the situation, which can be seen from many angles, and as you know, political arrangements and visions always change. So anyway, they were outraged by injustice, and they were attending rallies. And so there are people at the rallies watching to see who's especially fired up, who's especially enthusiastic, who has love for their country and hate for a certain enemy. And so they watch, and then they single you out and say, can you come to some meetings if you really want to do something about your love for your occupied nation and you want to do something against the enemy, come to our meetings. So then you go to the meetings, and you're presented that there is something you can do that will uplift the cause of real religion throughout the world, and you'll make a difference. And so they're recruited as suicide bombers. The psychological technique used is called the brotherhood mentality. Now, this is a select group, and you owe it to your group member to carry on the fight. You don't want to let your group members down. We're all in this together. Now, you may be a little cynical and say, oh, I'd never do like that. But human psychology is very malleable. And so these persons agree. And, of course, they're given theology instead of prosperity theology. They're given terrorist theology that, don't worry, when you blow yourself up, you will get a favored position at the right hand of God. And not only that, when the bomb explodes, don't worry about feeling the nails and all the other horrible things in the bomb that are meant to kill the people around you. It's not going to hurt you, because as soon as the bomb explodes, God will enter into the situation and protect you from all pain. Not only that, but because you became a suicide bomber and blew yourself up, your family gets special benefits from God. And, of course, we know, they would say, that benefits in the hereafter for your family are nice, but what about right now? Right now, as soon as you blow yourself up, we send your family a monthly pension. They got all the angles covered, the theological angles, the Social Security angles, and they take a video of you, and you have a certain religious text in one hand and a rifle in the other hand, and you're declaring your intent to be a living martyr. And so then this is before you do your deed. They take that video, your handlers, the group leaders, they take the video and send it to your family so you can't back out. In other words, you've already committed yourself. And the video is sent to your family, and they see, oh, our son is going to be a hero. And so you're being glorified. And so that makes it very difficult to back out. Well, I'm a martyr. My gosh, I'm going to be a martyr. Oh, okay. And they also take your picture. For when after you blow yourself up, your picture is going to be plastered on posters all over the city to commemorate you and also to inspire future suicide bombers. This glory could be yours. The glory of the hereafter and the glory of fame and celebration amongst the people. So what are not simply normal people, but above normal people in terms of the material sense, they are manipulated to do such horrible things. So then the question is, how safe are we as individuals from doing such atrocious activities? Perhaps in familiar circumstances, we can rely upon what we know as ourself to behave properly. But social psychologists point out that just radically change the situation you're in, and you're in a new arena, and you could do strange things. So I reminded the students at Stanford of a famous experiment done in 1971 called the Stanford Experiment. If you just Google the word experiment, in the top five results will be the Stanford Experiment, even though it happened in 1971. The social psychologist wanted to see how people can so easily be affected by circumstances, no matter how smart they think they are. So they got some Stanford students and said, we want you to volunteer for an experiment. We'll give you, you know, a little money, and it's all for the purpose of research. So some students are going to take the role of prison guards, and some students are going to take the role of prisoners. And we want you to act out those roles. We're going to make like a fake prison, and the prison guards and the prisoners will interact, and we'll just, and the scholars will observe all this and note down the results. The experiment was supposed to go on for 2 weeks, but it ended after 6 days because the students were getting so much into their roles, they forgot themselves. Those students at Stanford who had the roles of the prison guards, they were becoming sadistic. And the students who were playing the roles of prisoners, they were becoming depressed and stressed out. And even the scholars who were running the experiment and watching it, they were getting into it. Wow. And they were losing sight of any kind of parameters, so much so that outside scholars had to come and tell them, hey, this experiment is way off the rails. Everyone's really into it. There's sadism going on. There's depression going on. And you yourself, as the psychologist, you're caught up in all of it. Don't you see what's happening? And so that was a wake-up call, and they just ended the experiment after 6 days. It's a very famous experiment. It shows that we may think that we are very wholesome, nice people, but in the right kind of circumstances or the wrong kind of circumstances, our core values won't help us. We can be manipulated into doing crazy things. In bhakti, Krishna consciousness, we recognize the power of association. That's why Lord Chaitanya, when asked, what is the first symptom of a Vaishnav? He said the Vaishnav is one who gives up materialistic association, because that materialistic association will cause you to jump through hoops that you never believed you would do. You become under the influence of things that you thought would never influence you. So therefore, we stress in bhakti the power of association. I didn't want the students at Stanford to feel so bad that I was picking on them. So then I told them about another famous experiment at Yale University in 1974. I exempted myself because I had already graduated. So in this experiment, called the Milgram experiment, students were recruited for what they were told was an experiment to help other students learn better. And the idea was that there was a screen, and the learning student would be behind the screen. You couldn't see him or her. And the student administering the questions is on the other side of the screen and has a button to press that every time the learning student makes a mistake in answering a question, you get to press the button that gives an electric shock. And you can even turn up the button. As the student keeps making mistakes, you can increase the electric shock. So students were recruited, and the professors overseeing the experiment wore white coats and presented themselves as very official, and they explained that this is all for the glory of science, the advancement of learning. You are actually helping these students by shocking them when they make a wrong answer. You'll see that this is the best way they can learn. So you're doing them a favor. And furthermore, you don't have any responsibility for what you're doing. The professors take full responsibility. You are not accountable. So go for it. So the students got their hands on the electric voltage administrator, the controls. And every time they heard a wrong answer from this unknown student behind the screen, they turned up the shock, turned up the shock, turned up the shock. Now, these were like the most erudite students in America. Yet, two-thirds of them increased the shock to a point where the student who was learning would be unconscious. two-thirds of them went right into the lethal category of administering shocks. Yeah, this is helping the student to learn. This is an official experiment, and it's being supervised by erudite professors. I'm just playing my part, and I'm not even responsible. I'm not accountable. Two-thirds of them. What the students didn't know was that behind the screen was an actor, and that actually there was no electric shock. The actor was, you know, just moaning and groaning, oh, you're killing me. But the students didn't care. It's all for science. Stop. I can't take it anymore. The students didn't care. Turn it up. You gave a wrong answer. So two-thirds of the students did like that. Very few of them protested. No, this is immoral. This is improper. Very few, very rare individuals out of hundreds of students. The rest just got carried away by what they were told. This is for the advancement of learning, the advancement of education. You're helping these students to make the right answers. And anyway, you're not responsible. You're just a participant in the experiment. The professors are responsible. Don't worry. So this shows that no matter how strong we may think we are, in the wrong circumstances, we can be influenced to do things we never thought we would do. Hiranyakashipu had as his goal unlimited material enjoyment and power. That was not beneficial for him. He became mad by this. He terrorized others. He's a great testimony to how what seems to be a great material advantage actually becomes the greatest burden. Just like people who win the lottery. There's so many studies done of persons who win hundreds of millions of dollars in the lottery. And often they say they regret winning all that money because they don't have any real friends. Their life is turned upside down. So many of them have gone on record to say, I wish I never won the money. It's shocking. So this is what we hear. The word Durlaban indicates that one should not take benedictions one cannot enjoy peacefully. The intelligent person understands that no material benediction, no material advantage actually brings peace. So the yogi, the genuine yogi, does not look for peace on the material platform. And the genuine yogi, the actual technical meaning of yogi, is one who connects with the Supreme. The genuine yogi is not looking to the ultimate source, not looking to God for material benefit, because anything material will fade away, and it is not substantial. It is not what the spirit soul requires. So Srimad Bhagavatam is presenting the theistic science of pure love and devotion for God beyond any asking for material benefit. It is the essence. Srimad Bhagavatam is the essence of not my will, but thy will be done. In other words, I'm just a part. I'm a child of God. How can I dictate what is best for me? The Father knows best. That is the sign of pure devotion to the Supreme. The Father knows best. I'm a child of God. Let me just pray for pure devotion and pure love of God, regardless of material circumstances, regardless of material situations. This is the standard that Srimad Bhagavatam is setting. Of course, Hiranyakashipu is not interested in pure love of God. He has, he's demonstrating pure hatred of the Supreme. Hiranyakashipu is angry. Why can't I have everything my way? I want everyone bowing down to me. And so he creates social situations in which people are acting abnormally. Even Narada Muni, you'll hear, he's offering songs and prayers glorifying Hiranyakashipu. Not that Narada Muni is co-opted, but He's just going with the flow externally. What would we do in situations of apparent material reward in which we're not held accountable? You'd be shocked at what human beings will do. So when I was explaining at Stanford these various experiments, and I explained a few more also, I explained about the suicide bombers, because they all thought suicide bombers are crazy. Why else would you do such a thing? Then I explained that they're offered material benefits and religious benefits, that they will enjoy more in the future, and their families will enjoy right now. The whole world will become more prosperous by this horrible act that they're doing. So they're intelligent persons with families, even with children, and they sign up for this. So rather than just look at them as extreme cases, we should learn, we should apply some of that to our own situation. How are we being manipulated by material promises? So much so that we carry over those promises or hopes of material betterment. We carry that over even into our conception of heaven and the supreme reality, the spiritual world. See, what could the spiritual world be like? It must be like all the things I like to do here, but it'll be there better and bigger. Yes. I was poking my mother, which I shouldn't do. One of her famous preachers, who did a lot of good, no doubt, but he had a conception about what heaven is like. And he said, when I get to heaven, because a news reporter asked him, what do you want to do when you get to heaven? You're always preaching about heaven in some of the biggest sports stadiums in the USA. What are you going to do when you get to heaven? He said, when I get to heaven, I want to drive around in a yellow Cadillac. My mother looked at me, oh, you think you're so smart. Why did I send you to that university? I should have kept you at home and sent you to a community college. So, this kind of thinking, it affects all religions in the world. As I say, prosperity religion is non-sectarian. No one has the right to stick out their chest and say, we're immune to these things. But the Bhagavatam takes a particular stand against that. And that's what makes Srimad Bhagavatam such a unique spiritual text. It brings out that pure love and devotion to the Supreme. Not my will, but thine be done. It is your will, your pleasure that is our all in all. Not our tiny imaginary desires as little parts. This is the glory of Srimad Bhagavatam. Of course, Hiranyakashipu doesn't care for that glory of pure devotion. He is convinced, I am this body, and I'm going to enjoy this body. Sometimes Hiranyakashipu does speak about the science of the soul. It's amazing. You can remember from the 10th canto, Kamsa also gave knowledge of how we're not the body, we're soul. But in spite of that knowledge, they were totally dedicated to material enjoyment. It's quite a perverse situation that their knowledge of the science of the soul didn't affect their quest for material enjoyment. Okay, we're not the body, but so what? I'm going to enjoy the body. And at the time of death, I know I'll take another body, and I guess I'll just do the same thing in the next life, enjoy the body. So they would never think, such demons, they would never think that because you're not the body, you're spirit soul, you should be cultivating the activities of the spirit soul. No, they thought, we're not the body, we're spirit soul, but anyway, we're going to enjoy the body. That's just the way it is. And the last thing they want to do is have a devotional life to God. They don't care about Krishna. We are simply trying to have material enjoyment. and they don't want Krishna to interfere with their plans for material enjoyment. The whole world is operating in this way, and that is the great tragedy. Until we understand that focusing on material prosperity is alien to us, it's foreign to us, and will never become peaceful in this way, you'll not see lasting prosperity and peace in this world. This is the message of Srimad Bhagavatam for the entire planet. All right, we'll stop here and ask any questions. Yes.
Can that be applied to maybe when someone looks at, let's say, you know, people in Krishna conscious and they see them chanting with, and they believe that's like a mass consensual trance, like, you know, like it's just like a trance that someone's in, but it's not like, I don't know, do you get what I'm saying? Like it's like a cookie cutter consciousness when it's so big. I don't know, this is just speculation, of course.
Yes. But to external point of view, it could look like that. I was just thinking, seeing all these, our guests here, what would I think the first time I came here? See people putting their, bowing down, putting their heads on the floor, and they're spreading full out on the floor. And then you look on the altar and you see these statues. Ooh, must be idols. And you hear all sorts of strange music. And then you hear the spiritual texts, you know, talking about this Lord and that Lord, Lord Brahma, and then Lord Vishnu, and then Lord Krishna. Ooh, polytheism, believing in many gods. And then you hear talk about how you're not the body, you're spirit, soul. Ooh, this is denying the body. This is unnatural. On and on and on it goes. It's like when I mentioned to my mother, you know, In this day and age, people do understand that a flesh diet is not good for your health. It's not a controversial point anymore, Mother. I mean, she's 83. And then she'll do something that really gets on my nerves. She'll go to the Bible and pull a verse way out of context. She'll say, the Bible says, it's not what goes in the mouth that counts. It's what come out. It's what comes out of the mouth. I say, Mother, now wait a minute. Does that mean you're going to justify using this verse that you should eat garbage because it doesn't matter what goes in the mouth, but it just matters what comes out? So, yes, to an outsider who's not familiar with the deep purport of what goes on in bhakti, it can look like all those things. But if we really want to understand, we take the insider track. Just like how can you understand a bottle of honey from the outside? What would you do? You never tasted honey before. How do you understand it? You have to open the lid and stick your tongue inside. Well, similarly, if we actually want to understand what is spiritual reality and what is material reality, we need an authorized way of learning. And that's what the bhakti process is, how to perceive the spiritual reality in such a way that there is verification from the Supreme Absolute Truth. There's verification that you're doing the right thing, that you are increasing in your pure love and devotion. We're not solipsists that, you know, everything I do is just my own imagination. Everything I see, you're just part of my imagination. You don't really exist. You're just, you know. What if I thought like that? What would you do if I thought you're just a part of my imagination? I'm in a trance thinking that there's you. Oh, you'd probably throw the microphone at my head and let me know that I... Oh, is that part of your imagination too? So similarly, There is interaction between the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the devotee. And there's a whole handbook for such interactions. So nothing is left just to your fancy free imagination. Srimad Bhagavatam is an encyclopedia of pure devotion for God. And so all the different symptoms, all the different interactions are described very vividly. Otherwise, yes, if you're just left to your own mind, you could conjure up so many things and call it love of God. You could become a suicide bomber and think that you'll get a favored position at the right hand of God because of your horrible deed. Srimad Bhagavatam will clearly delineate what gives Krishna pleasure and what does not. What are the symptoms of someone who's spiritually advanced and someone who's not? So it's not that you're just left on your own imagining, well, I think I'm really spiritually advanced now. And you're not existing in this world just in of yourself. There are interactions that you can have with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And the whole process of bhakti is to attract that interaction. Anything else?
Previously, you were talking about grudges. In our devotional service, we may sometimes have a grudge against the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I was wondering, first of all, how do we discover what that grudge is? Secondly, how can we maintain a grudge against the Supreme Lord who is all-loving, so loving?
You see, this is the problem when you are attached to material happiness and prosperity. When you don't get it, you'll throw a tantrum. Like when you were raising your children. If they didn't get what they wanted from you, they would scream and yell, "Why haven't you given me this?" So this is the problem of prosperity religion. When the prosperity vanishes, which it often does in this world, as it's done in the USA since 2008, then why me? I've been worshiping God. I've been going to the church, the temple, the mosque, the synagogue every week. What happened? Where did my luxuries go? Now I'm losing my house. I lost my job. Or I'm getting so sick. How could God let that happen to me? So because you're attached, when I say you, I mean in general, because of our attachment to material happiness and prosperity as an indicator of God's mercy or a blessing from God, when it's taken away from us, as material nature will do, the ups and downs, the booms and the busts, we become angry and subconsciously we develop a grudge. How could God do this to me? To me! This is a universal religious phenomenon that has to be coped with. It's non-sectarian, this problem. And it can be transcended. The problem can be transcended by understanding what is the real mercy of God and not confusing that mercy to be material prosperity, material happiness. All right. So, I think we're getting a bit late. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.